This is the Porno Cultures Podcast, the show where we think about pornography rather than just react to it. To the Porno Cultures Podcast. Pornography is often talked about as this abstract alien thing that has no connection to the real world experience of any decent or good person. The thinking goes that since pornography is this anti-feminist and morally damaging abstraction, it must originate from a dark place, consumed with hate and misogyny. But what if I told you that in fact there's a whole spectrum of pornography dedicated to paying homage to the most cherished children's stories and beloved horror classics, like Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Dracula? And how would your opinions of pornographers change if you knew that they loved these books as much as you do? Well, that's all part of the story being told in this episode by our guest Laura Helen Marks and her book Alice in Pornoland, Hardcore Encounters with the Victorian Gothic. Unsurprisingly, Laura's academic background is in English, and this book is a product of her attempt to unite Victorian-era gender and sexual politics with contemporary pornographic narratives. While many people don't consider pornographic narratives too deeply, Laura's book argues that many pornographic tropes that we are used to today, including notions around a loss of innocence, the bisexual erotic undercurrents of Dracula biting both men and women, and the dual personality traits of pornography viewers themselves, originate from Victorian literature. While we often think of pornography as a medium indulging shamelessly in all types of sexual practices, pornography still needs to establish some type of taboo within their narratives in order for one of their characters to subversively upend the sexual norms. Incorporating conventions from Victorian literature within these pornographic narratives provides both the cultural norms and the characters willing to subvert them all within one book. Additionally, the obvious tensions between Victorian novels, where sexuality is only alluded to with metaphor, is finally liberated within pornographic narratives, where the underlying sexuality of these books are realized within pornography. Laura is a professor of practice at Tulane University. She fell in love with New Orleans while studying abroad as a master's student doing American studies. She's a Brit who in her youth thought that being a good feminist meant that you had to be anti-pornography. Needless to say, she has radically altered her opinion since then, and has quickly become one of the most essential voices in contemporary pornography studies. Alice in Pornoland is one of the most unique pornography books you'll ever read because of the ways in which it makes you rethink both classic literature and pornography itself. And the fact that it was written by one of the most publicly accessible and friendly scholars makes her work even more compelling. This is a special episode of the Porno Cultures Podcast because it's our first live episode recorded at Babeland, ironically, another Victorian-era reference, in Seattle, Washington. Both Laura and I were in Seattle for the annual Society for Cinema and Media Studies conference, and I thought that this would be a great opportunity to have a live episode where a bunch of porn scholars could come together to not only celebrate Laura's amazing book, but also honor the history of one of the country's most important sex shops, Babeland. Of course, we talk about the essential history of Babeland in relation to the feminist movement in our episode with Lynn Comella. So if you haven't already listened to that episode, be sure to do so. I want to thank the staff at Babeland for doing such a great job of hosting us and making us all feel so welcome. As they were setting up all of the chairs before the event, I was thinking to myself, goodness, all of these chairs are going to look really weird when most of them aren't filled. I really wasn't sure how many people would come to a live podcast of our show, considering all that Seattle has to offer. But to my surprise, most of the seats were filled with former guests, friends, and people that I had not even had the pleasure of meeting yet. So I was overwhelmed with the turnout, and I can hardly put into words how thankful I am to everyone who was able to attend. Your presence meant the world to both Laura and I. And considering the pressure of performing in front of a live audience, I think that you'll hear that Laura had the crowd in the palm of her hands. She did an amazing job, and she has enough personality and charisma to fill two Babelands. She's nothing short of a rock star. Thanks so much to Laura for being part of this amazing experiment. So without further ado, here is the Porno Cultures Podcast first live recording from Babeland in the Great Northwest.
I was awesome. Thank you. Thank you. I wasn't expecting that. Thank you so much. I'd like to welcome all of you to this special podcast event. We're here live in downtown Seattle inside one of the city's most exciting stores, the legendary sex shop Babeland. Thank you, Babeland, for hosting us. It's incredible. And we're here in Seattle for the conference, Society for Cinema and Media Studies. And because of that, we have an amazing collection of scholars in the audience joining us. Thank you for coming. Many of the people here have been guests on the show, and I feel a bit like Ebenezer Scrooge being visited by the ghosts of my past. Thankfully, it's not as scary as that, but you know, I'm actually really happy to see all of you guys back here. And I'm obviously really happy and honored that you all took the time to come out tonight, considering all of the satellite events that go on around the conference. It really means a lot to me. Once again, I want to thank everyone at Babeland. You guys have been wonderful and helping set all this up, and thank to all the employees who are working overtime in order to help us have as enjoyable event as possible. So please thank them for working overtime. And of course, I'm really super honored to be welcoming a new guest to the show, a new ghost in my life, Laura Helen Marks. Laura Helen Marks earned her PhD in English at Louisiana State University and is currently a professor of practice at Tulane University. Well, I'm guessing you really love the state of Louisiana.
I love the state of Louisiana.
I've never been there. I'm dying to.
You should come stay.
She's written about the history of pornography studies for the Feminist Media Journal. And with Rebecca Sullivan, she reviewed HBO's The Deuce for the site The Conversation. She's published articles with titles like Mirth and the Porn Scholar. And with Whitney Strube, also authored an article titled Mary XXXmas, A Brief History of Yuletide Smut. Laura is a good example of how far having a sense of humor can take you in academia. Academia needs more humor like yours, so thank you for that. She's also published a chapter in Whit Strube's and Caroline Bronstein's wonderful anthology, Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, where you wrote about another pornography based on a Victorian era story, The Passion of Carol. Mm-hmm. She's no stranger to podcasts either. She's a contributor to the essential podcast, The Rialto Report. And of course, we're here to talk about her first book, Alice in Pornoland, Hardcore Encounters with the Victorian Gothic, published in 2018 by the University of Illinois Press. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having
me. We both flew in today from the East Coast, so we're both on East Coast time. So if things get a little loopy, that's the reason why. Forgive us for being on the wrong time schedule. As you may know, we always like to ask the guests about their first experience with pornography. What was your first experience with pornography? Where was it? And what lasting impression did it leave you with that we find ourselves here today talking about pornography?
I'm from England. I grew up in England. So the access to pornography was different. I thought I had seen Deep Throat. I had not seen Deep Throat. And I thought the psychedelic swirls during the sex scenes were part of the movie, but it was just censorship. So the first uncensored porn film I saw was a German film. I don't know what it was called, but we called it The Baron. And it was a murder mystery VHS involving murder, urination, what you would expect from a German.
German. I don't know if German porn should be anyone's first porn. That's quite traumatic.
Yes. It was my boyfriend at the time had it on VHS, and they recorded the audio onto cassette tape and would play it in the car, and it was an obsession of him and his friends. That was my first introduction to pornography.
So they were really quite desperate to see this thing.
They loved it. It was funny.
And how old were you?
I was 19. Well, I guess depending on what you think of as pornography, because I grew up watching things like Eurotrash, which was Jean-Paul Gaultier, a French late night show, but it did feature pretty explicit sex stuff.
But not penetration.
Not penetration, but I have pretty vivid memories of almost penetration. I don't know if anyone's seen this show. Did they show penetration? But it was pretty explicit.
It felt like they showed
it. It felt like they showed it.
Sometimes that's all you need.
For a 12-year-old, it seemed pretty explicit. You know, we would have Channel 4, which show fairly explicit material, but we didn't really have hardcore material. And I also, being from England, grew up thinking to be a feminist is to be anti-pornography.
And yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You've made it clear that you were actually anti-pornography for many years.
Absolutely. I was. I never seen any pornography, but I was certain that pornography and really any form of sexual representation, I can remember feeling definitely a sense of insult, if that makes sense. So in some ways, that's actually helped me in empathizing with a sense of indignation. I can kind of see why men and women might feel overwhelmed by pornographic representations that just seem to be an onslaught. And I can see why some people sort of have that reaction, as wrongheaded as I think it is.
Did your parents feed that? Were your parents also speaking against sex?
No, they were really liberal. And I think that had something to do with it too. My form of rebellion. But I was reading James Herbert, who was a British novelist. He had very explicit pornographic scenes in his horror novels. And my dad called me out on that. And I lied and said, I skipped those parts. Which, I did not skip those parts.
As an English major, I'm sure you didn't skip those parts.
No, I reordered the books recently, and it's just as graphic as I remember.
Was there a big turnaround where you, you turned everything around?
I watched some pornography.
And that was all?
Yeah. It really was. I moved to America and I went to LSU as an exchange student. I did American studies and that 9 months in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, much of which was spent in New Orleans, it changed my life.
It changed a lot of people's lives.
Yes, I see it every day. The swamps. For better and worse.
For those who don't know what the book is about, Alice in Pornoland analyzes pornographic texts, recalling the visual and narrative themes of the Victorian era. Not only do you generally analyze pornography invoking Victorian themes, like the sexually repressed woman, the style of dress, and the racial politics of the time, but you subsequently analyze individual pornographic movies, paying homage to specific books from the era, including Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and Dracula. You write that pornographers use Victorians as a structuring device and as a vocabulary for precarious oscillating fears and desires concerning gender, class, race, sexual orientation, and technology. While reading this, I was struck that this theory is referring to Foucault's notion of the repressive hypothesis, right? For him, all the talk in the Victorian era about not having sex proves that the Victorians were actually consumed with sex. They weren't so much repressed as much as they evoked some type of sexual pleasure from the act of repression, right? So is it fair to say that this genre of pornography that you analyze in your book is the visualization of all that was repressed in the Victorian era? And if so, does this type of pornography have as much to say about that era as it does about our own?
Yes. I mean, short answer, yes. These films take so much pleasure in playing with these supposedly repressive discourses. I mean, it's really fun a lot of the time, and obviously was less fun in reality. I especially find the ones that use medical, sexological medical discourses as alibis for engaging in all kinds of perverse types of sex, exploitation. So many of them are comedies. They're very playful. When I try to explain the films to some people, they take away from it that they're filled with just rape and exploitation. And yes, many of them do feature exploitative situations, but they're riffing on or playing with these discourses from the past, but also using the fact that it's set in the past in order to play out things that maybe they wouldn't get away with if it were not set in the 19th century. I'm thinking of something like The Naughty Victorians, which is played out like a comedy, and there's really nothing very funny about that film. It's based on an Edwardian novel, but they changed the title to The Naughty Victorians, Ways of a Man with a Maid, and it's pretty horrifying. I mean, it's extremely violent, and the film really kind of acknowledges the violence of the original novel, but it's played with this wacky, almost in that jarring sense of A Clockwork Orange, where they play this sped up classical music. They play this funny, jocular music when the stuff on screen that's taking place is very violent. And there are a lot of those kinds of jarring, clashing tones in a lot of these films, which to me seems like they are acknowledging those roots. They're acknowledging that there is this dark source, but then they're also using that as like a little playground, a play space to act out some of those fantasies in the present day, especially in connection to class and race. Things that are a little bit more difficult to grapple with, perhaps, at least in an explicit fashion. Pornography grapples with racial difference and inequalities in sort of an abstract way, just through their categories. But with these films, they're like front and center. Like, this is set during slavery. This is about a master and a slave.
It seems like within a genre where you could literally do anything,
right,
you need to set up an environment where there are limitations so you can violate
them. Yes, absolutely. So it's like lots of doorways. Doorways, and I mean, my dissertation was called Behind Closed Doors, And even with the Roots parody, which is called Can't Be Roots, there are no doors. It's all outside, and yet the rhetoric of the movie is behind closed doors. It's all about this secret stuff behind closed doors, but it's all outside. It's in stables.
Ooh, where the best sex happens. Right? You write that the late Victorians were a revolutionary influence and that they had radical politics. Do you want to expand on that a bit? And is our contemporary pornography realizing their ideal, or do we still have a long way to go to match them? Because when you think about the Victorians, you don't think about it as being radical, but you put it out that they did have a radical politics.
They did have a radical politics. I mean, I guess in the same sense that, you know, do we have a radical politics now? Yes. But
I mean, I guess which context?
Right, exactly. About. So similarly, the 19th century generated the seeds for a lot of the progressive movements that we're seeing today. The free love movement of the 19th century that posited that you did not need to be married, you know, polyamorous relationships, etc. The feminist movement. These are origin points of various discourses that whether they have met their potential, I guess you could.
We'll talk about this later, but also with Alice in Wonderland, the regimented criminalization of pedophilia wasn't, you know, part of that era.
When I tell people that incest was not illegal until, I think it was 1902, but pornography of that time after they passed that law was like heavily incestuous. So you have that seesawing sort of reaction, and then, I mean, the age of consent was 11 up until pretty late in the 19th century, but you know, they passed that law. How progressive. But it was rooted in this reaction to white slavery and the fear of child prostitutes, etc. So
also, they were passing these laws in order to avoid child prostitution.
Right.
Wow, okay.
the anti-trafficking rhetoric is all rooted in...
You lay it out like that, that does seem quite radical. We've taken a lot of steps back. It seems like a lot of the radical politics within the narratives depends on speaking in allusions, keeping things hidden so one could be blunter with metaphor, right? You quote Josh West, the director of the all-male porn films Dr. Jerkoff and Mr. Hard and Gluttony, who says as much when he explains that repression necessarily forced the writers and artists of the Victorian period to find metaphors, terrestrial or supernatural, that gave voice to their unexpressed desires. So in your opinion, what is lost when the illusion is gone, right? I mean, nowadays, mm-hmm. It seems like everything stripped to the bone, we
right.
don't need an illusion. Or is there something new to be gained when sex is inserted into the narratives which were kind of overwhelmed with illusion?
I'm always hesitant to bemoan the loss of poetry because I feel like it's romanticizing something possibly, and at the same time I'm like, oh, they used to make these great. I mean, even I get nostalgic about pornography that was made when I wasn't alive, you know. They don't make them like they used to. But, I mean, I think there is something to be said for being straightforward.
Well, I think with this, though, that we know what the narrative is with illusions. And
yes.
Then we insert the thing that was supposed to be hidden. So there's something that we can see a live comparison of it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if I agree necessarily with what Wash West says, because his notion that everything was metaphor and illusion is rooted in a fairly popular idea of what Victorian literature was doing, when in fact it was a little bit more explicit or a little bit more complicated than that. Mm. And I think that if you are making something like Jekyll and Hyde and you're Wash West, he talks about how as a kid, he grew up in England in a working class family and he found these books like Dorian Gray and Jekyll and Hyde. And these were his like queer texts as a young boy realizing he was gay. So to him, this was this very exciting text that to him meant one thing. So, oh, here we have this really clear metaphor. But it's not necessarily just that metaphor. So there's this idea of the Gothic as being a technology. Jack Halberstam's theory of the Gothic as a technology, it's never static. And I feel even if pornography looks now as if like there is no illusion, there is no metaphor surrounding this, it is still utilizing this narrative. It is utilizing a narrative. Even Gail Dines. Gail Dines writes about, I know.
Our friend.
I know, I'm sorry. There's like one thing I agree with, and she says, Gonzo is not plotless. It does have a narrative. Of course, her version of what that narrative is differs from what I believe, but people think that pornography just shows sex, but I don't think there is such a thing.
I was intrigued by this quote. Did you find in your research that a lot of porn directors and actors were bookish into literature?
Yes.
What other examples did you find?
All of them wanted to talk about this stuff. They were so pumped to talk to me about Victorian literature. Sean Costello would not leave me alone about this project. And he made Dracula Exotica, which is a fantastic film. Wash West, who made those two movies, he made Still Alice. You know, he's a famous filmmaker now, and he was very willing to talk with me.
The movie with Julianne Moore?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I know. Okay. I mean, and he was like, yeah, I want to talk about Dr. Jerkoff and Mr. Hart. And Nika Noel, who persistently sets her films during the 19th century and also in other eras, but the 19th century is an era she enjoys, to where I said, there's no Wuthering Heights pornography. She's like, I'll make it. You know, they are very bookish.
I was wondering where the Frankenstein pornography
is. Oh, there is one.
Oh, okay.
It's directed by Paul Norman. Mm-hmm. And also a Joanna Angel Fuckenstein.
Fuckenstein, okay, yes. That makes sense.
It's pretty good.
I love Frankenstein as well, so I'll have to look those up.
There are very few Frankensteins. I think the aesthetics are challenging.
I think one of the things would be to keep sewing increasingly larger penises on, and then that would be kind of the plot point.
Well, there's the John Wayne Bobbitt porn movie.
Oh, okay.
That's Stein. His name, right?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
John Wayne Stein.
Good one.
You write that the Victorian Gothic provides porn with an erotic vocabulary. Could you expand upon that a bit? And what are some of the qualities that we take for granted in moving image pornography today that we didn't realize come from a model established by the Victorian era?
Okay, so our understanding of pornography today, I think we think of it as a fairly recent thing. And I have realized also with students that they think it started with videotape. They certainly do not think literature was ever or could ever be pornographic. And Walter Kendrick talks about this idea that, like, it's a post-pornographic era. No literature is going to get charged with obscenity anymore. And pretty much that is true. But even having said that, the Yeti and monster porn that they had on Amazon, once Amazon realized what they were selling, that was an issue. But I don't think they ever actually banned it or anything. But there are moments like that where people get kind of like, oh, wow, literature can be really graphic and pornographic. But this notion that it is an audiovisual medium, but also that Victorians are a very particular image and they are backward and they didn't have technology and they, you know, look a certain way. I'm talking about like my students and some people I speak to don't have a full understanding of all the technologies that were available, the audiovisual technologies, but also the sheer quantity of pornography. I mean, just massive amounts of pornography. So even when I've pointed that out and people are like, oh yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, there is all of this old Victorian pornography. Oh, and I guess Victoria's Secret, these sort of like little touchstones in society, then they kind of get it. So we tend to have these divisions through time of like, okay, here's where everything changed. It's a little bit more cyclical than that. And the technologies, they sort of like blur with each other. And the trajectory is less like, this is where videotape began, or this is where photography began, because photography had all of these precursors. So similarly with literature, literature was very visual after a certain point. And that language, I mean, if you look at the language of these 19th century novels, I mean, it's very similar to the visual language that we use. So the money shot, the meat shot, all of it is there in the 19th century. And then with present day pornographies, they're obsessed with their past. Pornographers are obsessed with the legacy before them. I think that's the one thing that people really don't realize, at least outside of porn studies maybe, is that pornographers are very interested in pornography and very interested in the history of pornography. And they have people they look up to and authors from the 19th century that they hearken back to. And I mean, I asked Nika Noel, she did make an adaptation of Ways of a Man with a Maid. And I asked her what she would want to make, like if she could make any movie, she said she would make it again. Just remake that movie and make it even better because she's so obsessed with that novel. And Nina Hartley on a Rialto Report talked about like she went to the movies once to see a porn movie and it was Autobiography of a Flea. She just thought, okay, this is something for me. So there is something in the seriality of pornography and the legacy. I don't think it gets acknowledged quite to the degree.
The legs of the vocabulary are much longer than yes. We imagine them being.
Yeah, I think we think of pornographers as just like money-grubbing, opportunistic, which many are, just like in any in any field, but many of them take this so seriously that they are like, no, I am doing something. I am placing myself within the sort of larger picture. I respect this genre. I'm disappointed in this in much of this industry, but I recognize where I am in this, and I'm sort of playing with this history and very conscious of it.
I was intrigued by one of the first sections in the book where you detail the racial aspects of the Victorian aesthetic. I suppose when I think about the Victorians, I mostly just think of the Europeans and not the implications of the American slave trade. But you go into that, and it strikes me that this accounts for the primary difference between American and European Victorians, that in Europe, the release of repression centers on monsters and imaginary places, while American Victorians centers on the real-life threat of the slaves that lived with them, right? Capable of raping them and kidnapping a white woman at any moment. What effect does this have on pornography, and what were the progressive ruptures in these racial texts that are encouraging audiences to think about race representation in pornography in new ways? You talk about an American pornographer doing a Victorian era set in America with interracial scenes.
Yes.
She was actually told that, you know, by her producers that was wrong.
Yeah. Right?
So there's interesting racial ruptures that are happening in these Victorian narratives.
Yeah, that was Nika Noel, and she did not want to market the film as interracial, and that's what got her into trouble. It seemed that she had to choose her words very carefully in the interview with me. It's called Family Secrets, and it doesn't acknowledge slavery, it doesn't acknowledge racial difference in a verbalized fashion. It is called Tales of Victorian Lust, Family Secrets. But it's set in America. It's not the Victorian era, I don't think. And it caused lots of confusion in reviews and things like that. But she essentially wanted to make an interracial movie that didn't use racist tropes, but did use the sexual titillation of interracial relationships. And so the 19th century seemed to offer that. But she did set it in America. It seemed as though there was a weird tension that maybe people don't think of European Victoriana as being anything other than white. Whereas actually Pandora Blake, who is a British pornographer, she talks at length about there were black people in London, and she has people of color in her scenes, but she absolutely does not use any like slavery narratives or servant narratives. But it's this strange tension. It's like, on the one hand, what is she effacing? What is she refusing to show? And on the other hand, you kind of admire this effort to avoid this language. But the question that interested me was, why set that in the 19th century? Because she did want to use the pleasurable tensions of racial inequality and slavery of that time, but she didn't want to, like, verbalize that. I mean, the studio didn't know what to do with it, and neither did anyone else. It flopped terribly.
Well, now it's going to be brought back to life.
I hope so. It's a good movie.
I was intrigued by your reading of Sean Castella's 1980 feature, Dracula Exotica. The film stars a very tortured Jamie Gillis as Dracula, who, to put it lightly, has a lot of issues when it comes to power over and relationships with women. There's an in-your-face rape scene to start off the movie, and there's also a scene of a male medical worker raping a female corpse. In your analysis of the film, you bring up Christopher Kraft's disturbing questions. When we think about the figure of Dracula, are we male or female? Do we have penetrators or orifices? And if both, what does that mean? And what about our body fluids, the red and the white, right? The red being the blood, the white being the semen. In your opinion, how are Dracula's themes of gender fluidity worked through in the many rape scenes in the movie? I mean, they seem to be so pronounced, they have to be telling us something. What are they telling us?
I don't even know. I really don't. Now I think it's a fantastic film, but as a baby scholar, I was really disturbed. And I think at the time I was really uncertain how to read pornography in a way that went beyond like, okay, well, this is just horrifyingly violent. But I initially watched it because I was going to write my dissertation about representations of sexual assault in pornography, which I immediately did not pursue.
You would have gotten a job with Gail Dennis.
Right. I actually turned the film off the first time I watched it. I mean, these scenes are really kind of hard to watch, but the second half of the film is like this lovely romance, and he recognizes the wrongness of his attitude and all of that. I have tried to puzzle through it's not just that film. Dracula seems to invite really violent sex scenes. Lots of necrophilia, lots of sexual assault and rape. I wonder whether it is the homoerotic tensions of the original novel and the inability for pornography that classifies itself as just one sexual orientation, the difficulties of trying to articulate those weird subliminal sexual ambiguities of the novel.
Yeah, because typically bisexual porn doesn't work. No one knows where to place it.
Right. And it usually just gets seen as being, well, it's gay porn mm-hmm. with women. Yeah. Which is disappointing. I would like it to be more. But with the Dracula movies, they tend to promise a lot. And it's all about blood and cum, you know. But these blood and cum just never really come together.
But there is a big plot in the second half with Vida Valdez.
Yes.
Who's a Hispanic.
It's all about
character.
Vanessa Del Rio, guys.
She is the one who gets raped on the medical floor when she's dead, but then she comes back and then she really dominates men.
Yes.
The guy who called her a spick, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an interesting way that the gender dynamics change dramatically through.
Yeah.
She has an interesting story.
Oh, I love this movie now that I have watched it enough times. But Vanessa Del Rio is a huge reason why the movie is so fabulous. I mean, Jamie Gillis is fantastic, but Vanessa Del Rio's role exemplifies the way that the vampire narrative repeatedly allows a space for performers of color to embody these monstrous characters. And it happens repeatedly in these Dracula adaptations that women and men of color are cast as either vampires or Dracula as this sort of like sexual, monstrous overlord in control. And the vampire women tend to be, yes, monstrous and in control to an extent, but it's sort of like the rapacious stereotypical in their performances of like racialized hypersexuality, but crossing into something that is much more about that performer. Vanessa Del Rio's performance is in the vein of Vanessa Del Rio as the screen persona that she cultivated, and the vampire is almost the perfect role for her. So I think on an initial simplistic read, you could say, oh, this is just a racist representation, a misogynistic representation, but it also creates some kind of space. I mean, this kind of goes along with what Murray Miller Young says about illicit eroticism, where black women in pornography were given these options, maid, voodoo queen, you know, here's this set of options, at least this is in the 80s, and many of these performers would say, oh, I'm playing the voodoo queen. And I'm going to rewrite this line so I can say this. And crafting these spaces to where these performances can push at those boundaries that are set around them and can create these very interesting, pretty exciting performances and scenes.
At the end of the film, he says that he's existed 400 years of being unsatisfied.
Yes.
I thought immediately of Twilight.
Yeah.
Where you have this vamp. So that goes to show the length of the vocabulary,
yeah,
stretching from Jamie Gillis to Robert Pattinson.
Yes, indeed.
Plays to a different effect. A little bit less rape in Twilight. And then my favorite line in the movie is that the cop is saying, he drank their blood, and not just from their neck. We can only imagine where.
So straight out the wazoo.
Another highlight, and of course we get the cover of the book from Alice in Wonderland, an X-rated musical comedy, 1976. Wow, what an extraordinary movie this is. I think of it as like the Wizard of Oz of pornography.
Wonderful.
I mean, it is extravagant.
It's like something you watch with your kids.
Yeah.
That's
what I
kept
saying.
Amazing.
I kept saying, where's the set?
I know.
Like, why is this not shown on Christmas time,
right,
or something? It just seems...
It's so fun, and the songs are good.
They really
the
are.
Dance sequences are fantastic.
It's hilarious.
It's
the one-liners are insane.
It's fun.
Could you tell us about the production? Because it seems like it could have been really expensive to make, yet it seems like they really utilized the sets to their,
yes,
best advantage.
Yeah, and it was very successful.
Well, Wikipedia says $90 million. I don't know if that's accurate.
I don't know about that.
And then it got a review from Roger Ebert.
Yes. So,
Well, Roger Ebert is a smut peddler. I mean,
he was
beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
It's true. So they released it in a soft version and then later in a hard version. And there is some slightly problematic stuff about...
I'm covering my ears.
Do I need to talk about this in the book? I must admit, I was a little bit conflicted. But basically, the woman who plays Alice was a Playboy model. There's a story that the blowjob scene, she did not believe that would be in the film.
Near the end, where,
yeah,
she's with her boyfriend?
And I think that there was some question about the ethics of the scenes that they included, but they cut these hardcore scenes into this softcore movie. But the softcore movie, I mean, it's made by the same people who made Flesh Gordon, so this was like during a time where they would have these pretty big budget, fun sex comedies, a little bit more racy than maybe people were used to, but they were released in cinemas, and they did really well. And the Alice in Pornoland movie, I mean, it seems to have become a beloved film of lots of people who went to see it at the cinema or watched it somehow. I did debate whether I could consider it hardcore in a classic sense, because if it was never intended to be hardcore and then they kind of rendered it hardcore, but it does have more than one or two hardcore scenes, and one of them I am a little bit conflicted about, but...
Is she not alive? Does she... Can she not speak for... I don't know.
She... I think she's still alive. Kristen DeBell.
So she could be found. We could ask her.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think she's fairly clear that that was not supposed to be in the film.
Okay. That seems like a whole Rialto Report series.
Was a Rialto Report interview.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. A podcast, but on their website. So y'all can go read that.
Now that I've seen the film, I will.
Yeah.
A real jarring line in the movie is when she says, "My body is all grown up, but my mind is still so little." And it invokes the unspoken para history about Lewis Carroll and his books. Of course, we know about his nude pictures of young children and their assumptions that he was engaged in pedophilic practices. As pornography scholars, it strikes me that we need a way to deal with this issue within pornographic text reflecting his work and this book. And it's really kind of set in that line about her body not being grown up. How do you go about incorporating this tension into your reading of Alice in Wonderland and the fact that Alice's mentality in the film is situated as one of a young child?
I would actually say it's not. To me, the film is about a woman. I do not like Alice in Wonderland, the book. I find it to be a horrifying, nightmarish hellscape that is not fun. And as a kid, I hated that book. To me, it seems like a nightmarish journey where a girl is being bullied by various different forces and then emerges fairly traumatized and then says like, "Oh, I had a great time."
And so, she's 7 in the book.
Right. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, really, I didn't have to deal with it because none of the pornographic films that I looked at were interested in engaging. Well, they use the iconography of Alice in Wonderland and the iconography of youth, and they would have narratives of growing up, but it was very much Alice is an adult, probably because of the fear of being seen as making something about children. But with the musical comedy, initially I did read it as, oh, this is just a story of a woman who won't put out, and her boyfriend's mad, and she goes and learns how to put out.
Yeah, it's kind of like Linda Lovelace, right? She doesn't know how to get on.
Right. But then I sort of thought it through and I thought, well, she comes back from this wonderland where she's told all of your sexual desires and all of these forms of sexuality are not seen as dirty. Like the creatures of wonderland in this movie do not understand what shame is. When one of them tries to touch her, she says, "Oh, I don't want to be marked," or "I don't want to be soiled." And he's like, "I'm not dirty. I'm not going to put a mark on you." Like, they are innocent and do not understand what this notion of sex shame is. And once she comes back from this wonderland, she is accepted back into this sort of system. So there's no shaming. There's nothing. To me, it was not about girlhood as much as shame-free womanhood. And the Lewis Carroll book is about trying to keep women as little girls. Especially Looking Glass. That is
flipping the
stuff.
Narrative.
Yes, yes.
You wrote a book about the use of humor in porn studies, us needing humor, our audience needing humor. One thing that I kept on thinking about in the movie, not only that there's not that much sex, but there's so much laughing in the movie. How do you balance any type of erotics in the movie with the amount of laughing that is obviously meant to be in the movie?
So many of the films I looked at were funny. I don't know. I like funny porn movies. I know people always think that like comedy and porn don't go together, but I don't think they clash. I think you can be turned on and also be having a really fun time and be laughing out loud. I hope.
The movie's lasted this long, so it's doing something.
It's
right?
True. That's you loved sure. It, right?
Oh, I loved it. It was fantastic.
So it works.
And then another one that you talk about, Dr. Jerkoff and Mr. Hard. Not as funny, but still funny.
Got some good jokes about academia.
Yes, it's about
the dude's
an academic.
A professor.
It's about an academic who is a loser. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know of any loser academics, but he's a loser and he takes this magic formula to become Mr. Hard.
Mm-hmm.
And
a studly, rock-hard body
dude. A lot of hot sex ensues from that. There's an interesting part of the book where I hadn't heard this theory before, that the porn viewer themselves is kind of situated as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
mm-hmm.
That when you watch porn, you can be this ravenous sexual creature, but when you're away from porn, you are the timid nerd. Do you buy that? You kind of critique it a little bit.
I do critique it a little bit. The person that came up with that was saying that porn studios use rhetoric to assure their viewer that their interest in these, what she believes to be violent, misogynistic porn movies, don't worry. Like, this is just a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of deal. You can do this and also be a good person, an upstanding citizen in your daily life. So in that sense, I think that there is some truth to that, in the sense that sometimes, especially if you hang out enough on fan forums, there are people who don't see any kind of conflict between who they are in their daily life and the kind of material that they consume uncritically. Hey, I just like to see women being psychologically broken down until they're crying. They got paid, you know, that's their attitude. And then in their daily life, they're like, I'm taking my kids to the, you know, it's just whatever. But that's not what Jekyll and Hyde was about. So it's really weird to me that the writer, Rebecca Wisnant is her name, that she would regard it that way. She also used that metaphor because there is a production studio called Jekyll and Hyde. I just feel like there's a fairly straightforward reason why somebody would, like, hey, be evil. There's something tantalizing about going to the dark side. So there are ways that porn studios use rhetoric to say, like, don't worry, you can indulge in this really violent, horrible material and you're not a bad person. I don't think Jekyll and Hyde is really the right metaphor to use for that.
Yeah, it just works as a standalone metaphor. Right. Not, it doesn't have any legs.
No, nah, exactly.
I love that you keep on going to, and you mentioned it already, is your use of message boards. How do academics go about utilizing message boards? Honestly, when I go to Reddit, or I just don't get
I spend how all
to
my
read
time
message boards properly.
Because I am a porn fan, and I am a porn nerd. I spend all my time online talking to people about porn.
Which sites do you go to?
Adult DVD Talk.
Are there Reddit, or?
I do not hang out on Reddit. But I've spent the last, I don't even know how many years, like, being friends with and hanging out on Adult DVD Talk. Sounds a lot less scholarly than maybe you thought it was.
No, I'm generally interested.
I mean, I've made some good friends.
This explains how you have so many Twitter followers. You've accumulated a cult for yourself.
Well, I mean, some of the people that we are colleagues with, I met through Adult DVD Talk.
If you want to identify yourself, please go ahead.
But I mean, it's really been a pretty awesome education. I joined it because when I was in grad school, I felt like I couldn't talk about pornography. They were not receptive to me talking about it as if
your,
I like
your colleagues.
Mostly my professors, but my colleagues didn't really have any interest. I mean, I'm sure other people can relate that it's hard to find people who have seen these movies, and it's hard to find people who will want to talk about it, like, as nerds. So I started a blog and I joined Adult DVD Talk and started hanging out just to be able to, like, speak my mind. I used the word fun, referring to one of the feelings you might feel if you were watching pornography or working in pornography. And I got taken to task in my general exams. It was just like, is this your word? Are you saying that this could be fun? Maybe. They were very upset. So I had to create kind of another space to express my enthusiasm for my beloved pornography.
Wow, what a story. Despite your aptitude on the message board, someone messed up royally when they categorized your book on Amazon, and you got all these reviews complaining about your book. What were they complaining about and why?
They thought it was a storybook.
They thought it was an actual storybook.
I have lots of really upset people. I have a 2.8.
Well, that's why we're holding events like this, to kind of rehabilitate the book.
They said it was a bunch of opinions and arguments.
And written by a woman on top of that. But what I found interesting about that kind of thing was that I didn't realize that, call me naive, I guess, but women are still, like, reading these books. We think of, like, the soap opera melodrama type books of the past, existing in the past, but I didn't know that was still a live genre. I guess Twilight and Fifty Shades of Grey.
Yeah, so. But also, like, You. Has anyone read that? Holy smokes. Yeah. That's pornographic. Like, nonstop. Yeah. I was amazed. And there's a sequel. Get on it.
Apparently my cousin has read it, so I'll have to look into it.
I mean, those kind of, like, psychological thrillers, to me, that's, you know, like Gone Girl and stuff. I know it's not pornographic, but, I mean, I love melodrama. I love thrillers, but seems like women never stopped wanting to, like, true crime, all of that stuff. Yeah, scandalous.
It kind of was a rupture that that made me aware of this still alive, you know, genre happening. Please, if anyone has a question. I know we have some English people in the audience.
Wait, from
England? English people and then English language people that know way more about literature than I do. So feel free.
Just, I think it's more of a comment than necessarily a question. I think it's really interesting.
What you are from England.
I am from England. Yes,
yeah. These are the screening sex people.
Oh, yes. Hey.
Hello.
It's exciting.
It's about Jekyll and Hyde.
Yes.
And I think it's a fascinating text because I don't think it's no coincidence that that was published the year that Psychopathia Sexualis came out. So this pursuit for language about sex and sexuality that didn't exist in that Gothic literature, I think it's got a lot in common with the pursuit of a visual language in hardcore porn narratives in the 70s. Do you think that's the case? There's some link there?
Jekyll and Hyde is an interesting one because I wonder how many people have read it. I mean, it's tiny. But also, it's the statement of the case is really what the story is. But really, it's so ambiguous. And I think that's why it's so rich for people to kind of, what's he really doing out there? But in terms of the 1970s, you're sort of drawing a parallel to how 1970s filmmakers were sort of responding to another moment?
Yeah, I think that the kind of desire to try and articulate some of the problems in sexual politics.
That's my alarm telling me to put up my tortoise. Sorry.
I think what they've got in common is that in the 70s, a lot of the hardcore porn tried to deal with shifts in sexual politics.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for a visual language to try and experiment, explore that, think of what that is, and it got caught up in the porn wars debates.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than be recognised for what I think a lot of it was trying to do.
Yeah.
Could be a deeply flawed and, you know, riddled with male rape fantasies and things such as that. But I think that's similar to what was happening in
That is interesting.
At the time as well with language. And I think it's no coincidence that in... Because I wrote about Jekyll and Hyde many years ago, that the first three feature-length adaptations took that ambiguity and translated it into sexual assault and rape. The first three films made Jekyll and Hyde had women being abused and raped.
Yes.
It doesn't happen in the novella at all.
No, a kid gets trampled.
Yeah.
And a man gets beaten.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that it came out... I think it was the same year or the year after as The Maiden Tribute of Babylon.
Modern Babylon,
thank you. Which again is this sort of like, children are being sold into sex slavery. These new discourses are bubbling up. But Stevenson's language is so vague and yet suggests so much. That's an interesting parallel for sure.
I'm Brian Watson at History of Porn on Twitter, but I come at porn studies from literature history of the book, really. So I do notice a lot of the trends that you identify of being in Victorian literature or even earlier before film. And what I really loved about your book was that it kind of like brings some of that history into film studies. Do you think there's a lot more to be done about bringing literature and history of the book into film studies?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, this book came about in a weird... It just kind of happened through frustrations in grad school and what my professors were telling me, like, well, you have to write about literature because you're in the English department. And that would happen all the time with people working on film. And I thought, I don't want to do the one chapter on literature. How can I integrate these together? And I didn't really realize I was doing something that unusual. But Kevin Heffernan actually was like, oh, well, this is important because of that reason. I mean, to me, it made sense once I started working on it that literature is visual in a weird way. And especially when you're talking, I mean, I'm talking about late Victorian period. That's like as visual as it gets. I mean, there's a reason why we have so many adaptations of these movies. But again, it kind of goes back to that, the illusion. Well, you can make all kinds of different versions of like what's really going on in these spaces that they don't talk about, right? But yes, absolutely. Even in the reverse, I'm working on a paper about novelizations of porn movies, which is a thing that happened in the 70s for like a very brief moment. But there is that very intimate relationship between literature and film that I think goes beyond adaptation in the traditional sense. I would love to see more.
I kind of have the same question, but in the opposite direction, because I also am in an English department trying to do sort of more of like an audiovisual project. And my department has a lot of Victorianists in it, so I'm always curious about how sort of the insights from people working in porn studies, if they could get sort of carried out to sort of a larger like academic audience, how they might change for example, how Victorianists are thinking about their period.
Mm.
So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about what you've seen in these movies and sort of the remediation of Victorian literature and pornography, how it might change how we think about, like, Victorian and Victorian period itself.
Yeah.
What could be learned in the opposite direction, I guess, if that makes sense?
Yeah. I had to make a decision when I went on the job market. Like, I realized I'm never going to be accepted as a Victorianist, and I'm not a Victorianist. And I don't think that people think of what I do as being literary studies. I'm okay with that. I am definitely more interested in the pornography side of things. But there is a weird divide. I went to the Dickens Project, which is this huge Dickensian... I mean, it's wild. And I was this, like, weird person. Oh, that's that porn person. As if it was this unusual side project. And it's like, y'all are Victorianists. Like, this is the bread and butter of the Victorian era. Like, this is a huge industry in the Victorian period. And so they were all very interested in Dickens, but they were not very interested in anything outside of a very particular idea of Dickens. In terms of marketing oneself, that does not go down well, to consider your work on Victorian pornography to be working on Victorian literature, for example, which I, you know, I made that case, I remember, in a job letter. I don't think they found it very appealing. But I think that divide, it's a really tricky one. But again, in the reverse fashion, I think that porn studies could benefit certainly from going beyond just looking at, like, one era of cinematic pornography, usually the 1970s. Now we're kind of broadening out to, like, these sort of other eras. But, I mean, I guess maybe because pornography is so different in each era that, like, if you're really into Radley Metzger, are you going to also be into Mason or, you know, William H., like, Massive Asses series or whatever? You know, these are two completely different structures of media. So I can't really blame somebody for being like, yeah, I don't mess with gonzo. I only work on narrative film. But I think that there is something to be said for looking at all of those types of pornography if you're really looking at pornography. But that's kind of a lot to take on, and especially when they are so different. But I think that broadening it out...
Thankfully now there's more of us now, so
yes,
we can cover our own...
Yes, we can cover it all. And there's, you know, massive asses in all of those genres. So.
Thank God.
Yes.
I had a related question about psychopathy and sexualis,
mm-hmm,
and the connections you see between sexology and pornography. To me, it seems like, I'm always struck by the fact that Tumblr seems like it's still a commitment to the taxonomic project of identifying,
yeah,
you know, demisexual, etc. It's like this vocabulary is,
mm-hmm,
as generative on the internet as psychopathy and sexuality,
yes,
trying to generate. But I'm just curious if you could say a little bit more about,
yeah, like categorization and, like, micro categorization. And I mean, now I guess Tumblr has been purged of,
yeah,
all of that. But I think it can feel punitive and restrictive if you are looking at these categories as being stable or limiting. But, like, when you enter a pornographic website and it asks you to choose, are you going to the straight side or the gay side? Even just that to me is just like, must I? You know, can I not have it all together? But then when you start to reach those sort of micro categories in the sort of organization, I think that's where it starts to become really fluid and interesting. And sexology was, I mean, it's pretty perverse pursuit of something. I mean, it's clearly rooted in that, whatever that impulse is. Once you start to browse and, like, navigate those categories and, like, traverse those pathways, it's actually an exciting journey. But again, the internet, as opposed to doctors, and there's a different power dynamic there. But as I said earlier, like, the pornographic movies where they do touch on sexology of that time are the funnest, raunchiest, like, really poking fun at that. But the Tumblr manifestation of that, to me, is, even Pornhub and stuff, is, that's, like, kind of fun. Especially when you're allowed to have multiple labels, like, as opposed to just, like, sitting in one category. But yeah, the Tumblr version of it, that's fun to me.
Yeah, we have one last question.
So it sounded like Wuthering Heights was a novel that maybe hasn't been,
it has not,
turned into pornography. I was wondering if you could either explain why you think that would be really interesting to do, or tell us other Victorian novels or works that you think would be great
Oh, boy.
Well, Frankenstein, we already have heard of.
So, I think Wuthering Heights would be a great porn movie.
They're apart for so long.
They are. But, like, I don't know. It's so, it's dark.
You have to pleasure each other to the letters to each other.
Yeah, and it's like, there's the ghosty hand at the window. And I don't know, there could be some BDSM-leaning stuff. But I think the reason it has not been adapted is because it's too complex. There's not enough visual representation that you can, like, work with. So even though Dorian Gray is, it's not like you can, with Dracula, cape, fangs, whatever. Not that all the Dracula adaptations are not complex. A lot of them are very fleshed out. But Dorian Gray, you would think, well, that's pretty difficult to adapt. But there are some key props and markers and you can kind of work with passing of time. Wuthering Heights is like intense relationships that require a lot of characterization, which, I mean, with a low budget film, I think you would have a hard time working with that. And that's why I think why Dickens and Jane Austen have not, why those books have not been adapted. I'm trying to think which one I would want to be adapted. I haven't even thought about that. Mill on the Floss? Just joking.
Not enough market penetration on that one. So thank you so much, Laura. You've been tremendous, and thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to everyone who made this great evening possible. It really means a lot. I'm definitely looking forward to doing another live episode soon. Be sure to check out the show notes when you have a chance. There are a ton of links to Laura's articles, some of the pornographic movies that we talked about, the Rialto Report interview with the star of Alice in Wonderland, and more info about porn star extraordinaire Vanessa Del Rio. While you're there, be sure to follow us on social media. You can follow us on facebook.com/academicsex and on Twitter @pornocultures. Thanks so much for listening, and I look forward to getting sexy with you next time. Bye.